It's 10 o'clock here in New York City at 99.5 FM WBAI. Stay tuned for Vantage Point with Professor Ron Daniels.
Good morning. This is the Professor Dr. Ron Daniels, President of the Institute of the Black World 21st Century and Distinguished Lecturer at York College, City University of New York. That's right, where I hail from, York College. Got to go teach today, in fact. Go meet those students and bring them across the finish line. This show is in collaboration with YCRadio.org. That's right, the York College radio station. And proud and happy to do so. Of course, this is 99.5 FM on the Pacifica radio dial. That's right, we're associated with the Great Pacifica Network. Today's show is the March 12th edition, and it is a Women's History Month program edition. In fact, all of my shows for the balance of the month will be devoted to women's issues primarily, and today's show will be no different. We will start it off with Maria McFarland Sanchez Marino, and she is going to be talking about a powerful book, There Are No Dead Here, a story of murder and denial in Colombia. And that is a, well, it's tragic in many respects, but it's also fascinating, revealing, and we'll be chatting with her about that. She is, of course, the executive director of the Drug Policy Alliance. And then we're going to be going out to Ohio, but she's bi-coastal these days. Or not bi-coastal, but she just hails from two parts of the country. Betty Dobson, no stranger to the WBAI listening audience, will be joining us for our Amazing Black Women section. And we'll be chatting with her. And then we go to Boston, where we'll be with Andrea James. Andrea James, an incredible story, another amazing black woman, founder of Justice Families and Justice for Healing, or Families for Justice and Healing. And she has an amazing story. She's an amazing black woman. And then we'll open up the phones and let you salute your own amazing black women. Sort of share with us, you know, someone that you'd like to give a shout out to that you think is amazing. Also be talking about a major event coming up. I'll be pounding it, actually. Follow up to the State of the Black World Conference, Newark, New Jersey, April 3rd Town Hall Meeting, dealing with the issue of From the Promised Land, From the Mountaintop to the Promised Land, King's Journey for Economic Justice. Danny Glover will be the special guest. I'll talk about that in the closing moments of our show. Just want to remind people to become a WBAI buddy. That's always incredibly important. Become a WBAI buddy. That way, we can just get thousands of people, thousands and thousands of people to become WBAI buddies. We'd have less fundraising drives. And that ought to be an incentive. You know, let's have just more programming and less, you know, having to come to our audience to appeal. We appeal because we have to appeal. If we didn't have to appeal, we wouldn't. But that's the nature of the proposition. And let me just say, I thank all of our listeners so much for supporting Vantage Point. We had a couple of shows in which we made appeals, and I understand they did reasonably well. And we appreciate that so much that you responded. And let's keep it going by becoming a WBAI buddy. What that means is you can go to give to WBAI.org, and you become a sustaining contributor. For as little as $10 a month, that means that, you know, it comes out of your credit card, your banking account, and you don't have to worry about it. I mean, I'm a WBAI buddy. I don't even know I'm one. It's gone. I mean, it's done, you know, and I don't have to worry about it. I don't have to think about, oh, I forgot none of that. It's just I am in the mix proudly as a WBAI buddy. Challenge others to do likewise. You can do 25, 50, 100, whatever you choose to do. And what comes with it is a package of benefits, you know, in terms of a tote bag, I think a T-shirt, but also there are commercial retailers that you get discounts for. So you get a hell of a lot for becoming a sustaining contributor. But the main thing is you are supporting the resistance, not only the resistance, but you are a part of the debate and discussion and movement for transformation of these United States of America and the world. And God knows, and the ancestors know, we need resistance and transformation in the face of the orange man, because he is a lunatic. All right, let's get started with our interviews for today. I'm very honored to have with us today, and we interviewed her when she came on as the new executive director of the Drug Policy Alliance. Today she comes in a different, not the same capacity, but bringing us a new book that she is the author of. We're delighted to have joining us Maria McFarland Sanchez Marina. Welcome to Vantage Point.
Thanks so much, Ron. It's great to be here.
All right. Well, let's, first of all, since this is Women's History Month, I just can't dive into the book. I just got to talk about you as an amazing person as well. So give us a little bit about yourself, as your background, a little bit about where you come from, and just a little sketch of who you are.
Sure. So I grew up in Peru. I'm Peruvian American. Moved to the U.S. when I was 20 years old and went to law school here, but was always interested in working on social justice causes, both here and abroad, and ended up joining Human Rights Watch as one of my first jobs out of law school, and covering Colombia as their Colombia researcher for 6 years. That was a real introduction to the war on drugs, because Colombia was at the epicenter of the global war on drugs at the time. And I got to know it extremely well, documenting massacres and atrocities.
Where did you go to school? Let's go back to, where did you go to school?
I went to NYU Law School.
NYU Law School, all right. Mm-hmm. But you went to your elementary
before that,
secondary was in Peru?
Oh, yeah. I mean, when I was very little, I lived in different countries. But from age 8 until I was 20, I lived in Peru. So I did from third grade on through my third year of college in Peru.
Okay.
And then last year of college at University of Texas at Austin.
Okay. All right. Well, I'm just trying to get some of your background. I know you want to dive into the story. I'm running the show. Okay. We're going to get to the book. Tell us a little bit about Peru, by the way, just in terms of, it's a country we know very little about. Just a little bit about growing up in Peru.
Well, I love Peru. It was, when I was growing up, a very poor country, a country that was struggling with an internal war. There were these Maoist guerrillas of the Shining Path.
Oh, that's right.
Like the Khmer Rouge in the 80s and early 90s, who were killing a lot of people, especially in remote regions in the countryside. And the military, in turn, was also killing a lot of people. And so when I was growing up, we were seeing in Lima, the capital, all of these people who had come into the city displaced by the violence and living in terrible conditions in slums around the city. At the same time, there was an economic crisis going on in the 80s. So it was a tough time. And then in the early 90s, we had a president who became an autocrat, Fujimori, who committed serious abuses. Yeah, well, he ended up going to prison. I was involved in getting him extradited from Chile to Peru to face trial later on in my career. But yeah, he became an autocrat. He oversaw a bunch of abuses, death squad killings in the name of fighting terror. And he also engaged in massive corruption.
He
actually was recently pardoned by the current president due to a political deal. So I'm still fuming about that.
The thing is, you got your human rights bona fides started very, very early. Look, let me ask you this question about this amazing book, There Are No Dead Here, A Story of Murder and Denial in Colombia. When did you get the idea to write this book?
It started after I finished working on Columbia for Human Rights Watch. I moved on to another job, but I felt the need to tell stories that I had seen and learned about while working on Columbia that you couldn't convey in a standard human rights report, right? Because the reports that I had worked on were for policymakers or for the public, but they were these very rigorous but ultimately kind of dry reports of fact. You know, these killings happened, this is what's occurring, this is how the government's responding. But you didn't get into the stories behind those facts. And I had also gotten to know a lot of very brave people who, in an environment where all of the pressures are to kind of look away from the violence, look away from the corruption, because it's dangerous to speak out, and because, frankly, you know, the economic incentives are to just go along with what's happening. In that environment, these people insisted on taking huge risks and standing up for what was right, fighting for justice, fighting for truth. And I wanted to tell those stories because so many Americans, what they hear about Colombia is Pablo Escobar, who died in 1993, so that's pretty outdated. Or maybe they've heard about the abuses by the FARC guerrillas, but they haven't heard about the abuses by the right-wing paramilitary groups, which were a big thing when I was working on there. And they haven't heard the good stories about the people who have stood up to the violence and the brutality, and often ordinary people who, you know, lawyers, journalists, activists, community leaders who, again, despite everything that's going on around them, fight with this daily courage in the face of what seemed like insurmountable odds. And I wanted to tell those stories.
So in essence, is this book really about, because, you know, we heard from so many years, I mean, this Colombia, the drugs, the effort to control the drugs and all of the cartels and all of this. So is the essence of this book sort of the corrupting, corrosive nature of the war on drugs and how people have tried to struggle against this? Tell us about sort of the essence of the book.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's definitely one of the underlying themes that that people don't understand very well outside of countries like Colombia and Mexico, which is that the war on drugs, the fact that we have prohibition and criminalization as the main response to drugs, means that you've created this massive illicit market in drugs, which fuels organized crime. And so in a country like Colombia, you've had, it was a country that was at war for a very long time, but when the illicit market in drugs started to gain power, that gave this incredible source of wealth to these groups that were supposedly fighting for ideological reasons, and distorted all of their motives, right? So then they started to fight over control over territory. And especially the right-wing paramilitaries, who really started expanding in the late 90s, were among the country's biggest drug traffickers. They were the ones who stepped into the shoes of Pablo Escobar after he was killed. And they started killing people, you know, by the thousands in these horrific massacres across the country, supposedly because they were fighting the left-wing guerrillas. But in reality, a lot of it was about control over territory so they could move cocaine through it. And that wealth that they also got, and as a result of the drug trade, meant that they could buy off police, military, members of Congress, and they became the most important powers in many regions of the country. So totally subverting democracy and the rule of law and making it extremely difficult for the country to ever move away from violence and corruption as the main way of working things out. And even today, when you have a peace deal with the FARC guerrillas, I am very concerned that as you see the FARC move out of the territories that they were controlling, you're just going to see new armed groups, new organized crime groups step in, because somebody's always going to want to control that illicit market, and they're going to continue engaging in violence to control it.
So one of the things that you apparently established in the book is just, on the one hand, while the the government is proclaiming its war on the drugs, that you're saying that essentially they were almost bought and sold and deeply complicit with this illicit traffic. Is that a correct interpretation?
Well, so yes, in many ways, yes. Particularly with the paramilitaries, so I was saying expanded in the late 90s, they worked very, very closely with important sectors of the military and eventually with much of the Congress. So one of the main characters in my book got killed early on because he was one of the first people starting to talk about the links between the paramilitaries and the military and how the military was covering up their massacres and atrocities. And then a second character in the mid-2000s was an investigator on the Supreme Court who uncovered how the paramilitaries were working closely with about a third of Congress and had conspired with Congress to rig elections in their favor. So, yeah, these groups did end up having tremendous influence because of, again, their wealth and control of different areas.
Now, you traced, I guess, three people in the narrative of your book, and you talk about their incredible courage. Talk to us about that. I mean, these are people, in one instance, you talk about the wife of one of these persons who was being threatened herself but refused to tell her husband for fear that he would not continue. I mean, what is it that drove or even drives people to have that level of courage?
You know, I'm still puzzling over that. I think in some ways this is just who these people are. They couldn't do otherwise. One of the characters, Ivan Velasquez, who you were mentioning, his wife, you know, he's said before that for him to not investigate or not pursue claims of injustice when they come before him would be such a betrayal of himself that he just wouldn't be able to live with himself. He might as well, you know, not do anything. These are people who have always been idealists. And when you talk to them or to their families, it's just come from their youth. They're people who believe that, that you have to fight to make the system work for people.
Right.
And that if you give up, then you're basically complicit in what's happening.
Right.
And that's unbearable to them. And so they fight even when their lives are at stake. And when many people around them are being and have been killed.
Now, you earlier talked about prohibition and legalization. You threw some terms out, and in the interest of transparency, the Institute of the Black World 21st Century partners with the Drug Policy Alliance. But I think there's a tendency on our part to assume that everybody knows what we're talking about because we're in the field, you know. And I don't want to make that mistake. So, I mean, for many people, prohibition seems to make sense. I mean, why would we not prohibit people from having drugs? I mean, drugs are terrible. They hurt people. They harm people. And people fight over them and so forth. So I think it would be good to talk about why is this war on drugs the wrong approach, both in places like Colombia and around the world, and indeed there are many, many leaders, Kofi Annan, many others who are coming forward to say this is the wrong approach. But it's not been easy necessarily to convince people of that. Make your case that this is not the right approach in Colombia, for example.
Yeah, I mean, in people in the U.S. Have been convinced to look at criminalization and prohibition as the only way to deal with drugs, because that's been what the U.S. government has been pushing for a very long time. But that's not necessarily the way other countries have dealt with it, at least with the personal use of drugs, right? So there are countries that have decriminalized personal use of drugs. There are countries that never criminalized the personal use of drugs in the first place. And that means recognizing that at least when it comes to what you consume, what you choose to put in your own body, that's a personal decision. And as long as you're not harming others with it, it's really inappropriate to threaten your liberty for doing so. And there are better ways of dealing with the problems that are associated with drug use. Like people, you know, obviously some people do have problematic drug use, and those people need help. Those people need, you know, advice. They need access to treatment if they want it. In many cases, they need many other services because they're grappling with a whole bunch of problems in their lives, mental health issues, lack of access to housing, employment, and so on. And other countries do a much better job of treating those problems that are, that can be associated with drug use as a public health issue, as something where you can provide different forms of support to get people to a better place. The fact is the U.S. has been engaged in this war on drugs approach for decades now, and you haven't seen any meaningful reduction in problematic drug use, nor have you seen any meaningful reduction in drug supply. It's basically an ideological approach because of a lack of imagination, because policymakers are so committed to this way of doing things. Now, in a country like Colombia, you're seeing, or Mexico or Afghanistan, you see an additional set of problems, which is what I was talking about before, how prohibition fuels organized crime. And there you've seen presidents now and leaders like Kofi Annan pointing out that we need to think about a different approach to drug policy that reduces the resources going to organized crime.
How would that be done? How would that be done? I mean, that's the obvious question to people saying, well, if you legalize it and whatever, how would that sort of get rid of the Pablo Escobars or these militias? I mean, the drugs are still there. How would it practically work that it then sort of reduces the terror, crime, and illicit traffic and so forth?
Yeah. I mean, I think that's something that needs to be figured out very carefully, very gradually. You don't want to, you know, legalize and say that's going to solve all the problems, because we don't know exactly what would happen. But we do know, for example, that we have seen some steps towards marijuana legalization in a number of states, and even the Department of Justice, under Eric Holder, pointed out in a memo when they said that they weren't going to interfere with marijuana legalization in those states, that by moving control of the market in marijuana into a regulated space, that you were shrinking the space for illicit markets. And it might reduce the power of organized crime. So that's something that needs to be studied. We need to understand better what's happened in states that have legalized marijuana, what the impact has been on organized crime there, and the market supplying illicit marijuana in those states. And I think the main piece of advice is what the governments of Mexico, Colombia, and Guatemala were calling for a while ago, which is we need to start this conversation. We need to start thinking about alternative approaches. Nobody has the answer yet because it hasn't been done anywhere. But we need to break out of that closed off way of thinking that is, okay, the only way to deal with this is criminalize, prosecute, enforce. Because I have seen personally how the U.S. arrests, extradites, kills the leaders of these criminal groups in countries like Colombia, and the only thing that happens is that somebody else steps into their shoes.
Right. Well, I guess one of the things too, I guess we can point to, is it's not identical, but certainly there was a lot of gang activity and illicit wars and everything around prohibition of alcohol, and certainly legalizing alcohol in the United States is at least that part of the illicit traffic and all that has been. I guess there's still some moonshining and some bathtub gin being made, but it ain't the dominant narrative no more.
Right. Yeah. I mean, you want to look at ways to reduce the harms of prohibition, including organized crime, while also making sure that you are keeping an eye on the harms of drug use. And, you know, any regulated system that you might create you need to look at all of those pieces, and you need to look at all the incentives that you're creating. This is not something that you just embark on, you know, all of a sudden and assuming you have all the answers, because it's a complex policy issue. But I will say that what's most immediately a step forward that the U.S. could take, and there's no reason not to do as soon as possible, is decriminalizing personal use of all drugs.
Right.
Because, you know, this is a huge issue in the United States. You have more than 1 million people arrested every year simply for using, you know, possessing drugs for personal use. It's the single most arrested offense in the country. You have four times as many arrests for personal drug use, you know, as for all violent crimes combined. I mean, this is a big, big thing.
Right. Well, let's tell people how they can get the book.
So the book is available at bookstores and all the standard outlets that you can get books on online. And it's called There Are No Dead Here, A Story of Murder and Denial in Colombia.
Mm-hmm. Now, before I let you go, I want to just take another sort of sidebar, because in my capacity as with the Institute of the Blackwell 21st Century and doing work around reparations, we also have been looking hard at Colombia in terms of the, and I don't know that you've had any experience, I thought I would ask you about it, the tremendous impact on Afro-Colombians caught up in various ways, including the crossfire between the FARC and these militia groups, and some of it, of course, is also related to the drug war, I'm sure. But I'm just wondering, and, you know, we get reports almost every week of just people from the Washington office on Latin America, this, you know, this people being just killed, almost every week, two or three people are falling. And I'm just wondering whether you, either in Human Rights Watch or while you were there, had any association or any sense of what was going on in relationship to this. I mean, people don't realize how many Afro-Colombians there are, millions. You know, it's probably the third largest population of African descendants in the Americas.
Yeah, there are a lot of Afro-Colombians, and they are overwhelmingly poor, marginalized, suffer from discrimination. And many of them live along the coast, the Pacific coast. And so I did visit some of the worst hit regions like Chocó, like Tumaco, where Afro-Colombian communities have repeatedly been the targets of violence by both the guerrillas and the right-wing paramilitaries and the military. And many of them have been forcibly displaced from their land. A lot of them have a right to their ancestral territories in Colombia, but many of them have been forced out of those territories by armed groups, particularly by the paramilitaries, who, you know, wanted to control that territory because, again, it was often on the way to access to the ocean, so they were strategic corridors for moving drugs. In the region of Tumaco in the south of the country, the FARC has had a significant presence recently, and as they are moving out, again, there are new problems with new groups coming in. There are big coca production areas there, and unfortunately, many Afro-Colombians are caught in the middle of all of this violence. You know, they have very troubled economies, and on top of that, you have armed groups forcing them to, you know, go in one direction or another. It's devastating.
Right, it is. Yeah, I just wondered, you know, while I had you on, I just asked about that, because this is an issue that many of us are trying to focus attention on, and it's good to hear what your observations are in that regard.
Mm-hmm.
Again, we thank you so much for being on with us today, Maria McFarland Sanchez Marina. And the book is entitled There Are No Dead Here, A Story of Murder and Denial in Colombia. And it is an amazing book. And we want you to go get it. And you can get it on all the traditional outlets, Amazon and others that are out there. So we hope you go take a look at it and learn from it, because we've certainly heard a lot about it. But to see, have these firsthand accounts of the courageous struggles of individuals against corruption and the fight for democracy in the middle of this corrupting war on drugs is something that you need to hear about. So, Maria, thank you so much for spending time with us this morning on Vantage Point.
Thank you so much, Ron.
Okay, all right, we're going to take a break here, come back. It's going to be Betty Dobson. Many of you know her as the co-founder of CMOTAP. She's an amazing black woman, and we'll hear from her next after we take this brief pause.
Loved Tommy. An exemplary young man. He was married and the father of one little girl, Maureen, whose godmother I was. He and his wife, Betty, were the best friends I had in town. He owned his little home, and having saved his money, he went into the grocery business with the same ambition a young white man would have had. One of the morning papers held back its edition in order to supply its readers with the details of that lynching. It said that Thomas Moss begged for his life for the sake of his wife and his child and his unborn baby. That Calvin McDowell got hold of one of the guns of the lynchers, and because they couldn't loosen his grip, a shot was fired into his closed fist. There's a strong belief among us that the criminal court judge himself was one of the lynchers.
The black community of Memphis was stunned. Wells retaliated with her pen. She wrote an editorial.
The city of Memphis has demonstrated that neither character nor standing avails the Negro if he dares to protect himself against the white man or become his rival. The white mob could help itself to ammunition without pay, but the order was rigidly enforced against the selling of guns to Negroes.
This is something that touched her, not just as a woman who is sensitive to the injustices were being imposed upon blacks, but there was a personal note in and all that I think forced her to ask the question, am I willing to stand up to whoever may oppose me in trying to in fighting for racial justice?
Okay, we're back. We thank our chief announcer, Michael G. Haskins, for that insert, which is from Ida B. Wells, A Passion for Justice, read by Toni Morrison. Excellent insert for this Women's History program. As throughout the rest of the month, Vantage Point will be saluting women, but particularly amazing black women here on this show. And we're delighted to have one of those amazing black women join us now. And that is none other than Betty Dobson. Betty Dobson, welcome to Vantage Point.
Good morning, and thank you, and glad to hear your voice.
It's good to hear your voice too, homie. And in the interest of disclosure, you're out in Youngstown, Ohio these days, and I hail from Youngstown, Ohio too. Didn't know about you until I got up here. Of course, now you lived in with the Elites up there, as they said. You was out there in the McGuffey Heights area. I was over with the poor working class people over in the north side, so that was a little bit distinction.
Listen, Ron, you left your footprint all over Youngstown, everywhere I go, before I can say anything. Do you or did you know Ron Daniels? And I'm happy to say, yes, I know that brother. And they tell me all those things that you were doing here. Amazing.
Right. Well, so Youngstown, Ohio, tell us a bit about your roots in Youngstown. I discovered years later, sort of people that, because I know you had a family reunion here somewhere, I forget what it was, and then I began to intersect with people. I say, oh, gee, I didn't know Betty was connected to this family and that family and whatever. So your roots in Youngstown, Ohio, tell us a bit about you as your background.
Well, it was the roots were both in Youngstown and Hubbard. Hubbard was just a little stretch of land outside the village of Hubbard, all black, poor black folks, actually. But our activities were all in Youngstown, the church, the parks or whatever. Everything was in Youngstown. Went to an all-white school in Hubbard. Was not a pleasant experience, but it was the school was very highly rated, and it still is. And so I do have to be grateful for that. Large family. We went to First Baptist Church in Youngstown. My father was a revolutionary in his own right. My mom, she was more or less just a wonderful mother. She didn't get involved in politics and that sort of thing.
Wait. Listen, you can't pass over your revolutionary father like that. Now, tell us about your revolutionary father.
My revolutionary father was run out of Georgia, Leesburg, Georgia, for a very strange reason. He was told by the sharecropper on the plantation where the family was located that he could not marry my mother until the harvest was over. But they were in love, and so my father decided they went ahead and got married. And so the owner of the plantation heard that my father had disobeyed him and gotten married. And so he came to my grandma's house with the intention of giving my father a real shellacking. You know, then back in those days, they could do whatever they wanted to black folks. And so my father was in a barn. He was down in the barn. So the man's name was Charlie Shepherd. I'll never forget it. And so he went to the barn to give my father this severe beating to remind him that he had to be more obedient. Of course, my father took what I understand was a whip. He took that whip from him and left him in a bloody mess. He nearly killed him. And he never went back home. He just started running.
Right.
And my father tells us that he was young. He was only 20 years old at the time. And so he would hide along the side. There were lots of bushes and things. And he saw an old man, a black man, in a wagon. And he crawled out of the bushes, and he told me, he says, listen, I got to get out of Georgia. I had a run-in with the plantation owner, so the man told him, crawl in the back of my wagon. Cover yourself. And when I get to the train station, I will start to sing. And when I start to sing, you jump out because you are near a train station. So when he heard this old man singing, hey, Lord, hey, Lord, hey, Lord, he jumped out of that wagon, and there he was, jumped on a freight train, nothing but the clothes on his back, ended up in Philadelphia. And he said that the way that he lived, he would go into a place, pick up a broom and start sweeping in front of it, and ask the person to give him something to eat. Well, he went from that. Somehow or other, he ended up in Youngstown, Ohio, got a job in the steel mill.
The steel mill, of course.
That's right. And sent for my mother, and that's how we ended up in that little part of the world. Well, I don't have to tell you how he felt from that day forward about white people.
Right.
But he taught us to respect everyone, but he taught us that everyone must respect us. And so whenever anything would happen in that school, and plenty of things happened because, you know, we were little darkies and what have you. So my father would be there the next day demanding that his children be accepted, demanding that anything that any of those other children were exposed to, that we had that same exposure. Any trips that they went on, we had to go on. And he did, he wasn't an educated person, but he was very, very intelligent.
Right.
And so he worked with the church and through the church and helped many people in the organization and became bosom buddies with the mayor of Hubbard, Ohio, and they remained friends until the end of their lives.
Wonderful. Now, see, if I had skipped over that question, look how much you share with your audience just from that one question. See, that's why I have to dig into your background. That's an amazing story. And by the way, it parallels the story of many black men and perhaps some women, too, who took a similar route, who had a clash with a white person, a white man. Some even killed some of them. And then they had to, you know, make a hasty retreat to the north. I've heard those stories within my own family, on both sides. You know, some instances can't trace back because there's a story that there was clashes with white people, and you know, people had to escape to come up to the north. And so you land, so you're in Youngstown, Ohio, and then you were about to tell us more about your upbringing and some of the things that helped to shape you as the Betty Dobson that you became.
Well, I have to give credit to my mother, as well as my father, and as well as everybody in that small community. Mm. It was, we often, now that we're, you know, grown and many of us are elders, we often talk about what an incredible upbringing we had. There was about 12 families that lived in that little alcove, if you want to call it that, and they all had children. And large families, because back in the day, you know, you folks had large 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 12 kids. And so I don't know how the community came to understand that every child in that little community belonged to them.
That's right.
And so it was kind of awful because, you know, we tried to get into trouble and there was always an eye on us.
Couldn't get away with nothing.
And listen, and if they thought you were too far out of bounds, they would just go and pick a switch and you know, let you have it. And then call your father or your mother or take you there, and you get another one. So we used to just, we learned to be very sneaky. You know, we had to hide behind trees and garages and things to do that little stuff we wanted to do.
Right.
But those people loved us, shared their lives with us. Some of them were known for certain things. There's a woman who used to make cornbread. Every kid in that community used to come by Miss Cornwell's house to get a little piece of cornbread. You know, it was those kind of things that I remember most and those things that shaped me. Everybody helped each other. There was no such thing as you looking down on your neighbor because your neighbor was your friend and it was your responsibility to look after your neighbor's children. So I grew up in that, under that village concept. And I still try to embrace it. Youngstown is different now, Ron, though. But,
yeah, I know. It's been,
you know,
it's been...
I remember it, and I still try to embrace and use it when I can.
What brought you to New York?
Well, my godfather was my uncle, and he came from the South and came to live with us for a little while. And many of my father and my mother's relatives passed through our house and then went on to other places. Well, my particular godfather, he went to New York. And being a country boy, he didn't know that cabs would run over you and kill you. And he was hit by a cab, and he was killed.
Oh,
and because he was my godfather, I was the only one of all the children that were able to come to New York to his funeral. Well, my aunt drove to New York, and she wasn't accustomed to New York traffic, and so she hit an embankment with her car, and the car had to remain 4 days in New York in order to be fixed before she could drive back to Youngstown. Well, someone had the idea, said, you know, my girlfriend's son is home from the service. I'm going to call him and see if he'd take Betty for a bus ride. And they called him. His name was Julius.
Oh, my goodness.
So he came over, took me on the bus ride. We started corresponding. Then we started telephone calling. And then he asked me to marry him.
That was
and then I told him he had to come and meet my family. He came and he met my family, and they approved of him. And so I married Julius Dobson and went to live in New York. And that's how I ended up in New York.
Oh, what a ride. That was a ride of a lifetime. Oh, my goodness. I know. And that was, I know so much. I mean, there was such a, you, the two of you were such a wonderful, wonderful couple, you know, the reinforcing each other in so many different ways and so forth.
Well, oh, I had a wonderful husband. Wonderful.
Well, it's well known that you brought that reinforcement and guidance from your mother and that passion from your father to New York, because you soon immersed yourself in the social justice, human rights struggles here in New York, and out of which became a major, major organization. So tell us about that immersion. How did that come about? Because in the Big Apple, a lot of stuff going on, but you certainly distinguished yourself by creating an organization, an institution.
Oh, I'll tell you. I was the public relations director at Harlem Hospital. I was there for 15 years. And while there, I started to notice that these reporters would come by on Friday evening, take a seat, and wait for blood and gore to come through the doors. And at first, it wasn't bothering me, but then I noticed, why are they camping out here? They were camping out because they wanted to get the kind of news that they were told to get. Mm. You know, black people violating each other and shooting and all this kind of stuff. And I was in the emergency room, and they were pushing this man through on a gurney, and I saw this reporter run over and put a microphone in his face and say, you know, who shot you? What's his name? Do you know where he lives? And the person who was pushing this dying, nearly dead person into the emergency room stopped to allow the reporter to interrogate this person that's lying on this gurney bleeding. And I said, no, I got to stop this. Now, mind you, I was just the public relations director, but I went to my boss at that time, and I told him, I said, listen, this is ridiculous. They're not supposed to do that. And it kind of stopped some of it. But then I said, I can do more. You know, I can do more than just try to stop this nonsense. I can create something that would make a difference. Now, I was told to invite, at that time I was very much involved in my church, St. Albans Congregational Church in St. Albans. And so, a young woman there asked me to host a media education forum. Name was Diane Glover, and I did. And I invited Utrice Lead and two other brothers, whose name is escaping me now, but I'll think of them in a minute, held this meeting. And so it was Utrice Lead that said, Betty, why don't you all create an organization and have that organization monitor what is going on in media, both electronic and print media, and then confront the gatekeepers with it. Well, I had the idea, but I hadn't put it together. It hadn't gelled in my mind. But Utrice was the one that enabled me to think, maybe she's absolutely right. And so I spoke to my minister, and I said, you know, I want to hold a meeting here, and is it okay? He said, fine. His name is Robert Johnson. He's passed. He's now an ancestor. Held that meeting, and it was packed to the rafters. Mm. I was really surprised. Black folks are so sick and tired of being represented so negatively in media that they flocked to that meeting. And, you know, I said, oh, well, this is wonderful. So then we started taking names and addresses and asked folks, do you want to join? Well, everybody wanted to join. And within 6 months, we had almost 1,000 people who had joined what we now know as CEMOTAP. Mm. Well, after that, we were kind of on fire, Ron. We said, well, if we got this many people, we can hold some demonstrations. First demonstration we held was when there was this, runner from Nigeria. I think it was Nigeria, one of those countries. Ibrahim Hussein. He won the marathon. but they failed to photograph him running through the finish line, you know, going through that tape.
Right.
They had the cameras focused on a white guy who was about a block and a half behind Ibrahim Hussein.
Right.
Now, I have to tell you this. When we spoke to Ibrahim Hussein, he said when he got to 135th Street in Harlem, he was finished. He said, but those people had drums and was singing and dancing and screaming and telling him, go ahead, brother, go ahead, go ahead. He said it was like lightning struck him. He said he took off with a speed he didn't even know he had. And that is how he won that marathon.
Right.
So the Black World in New York, we were offended, very much offended. And so that was our first demonstration at WABC TV to find out why in the name of heck did this man, the first African to ever win the marathon, and he wasn't photographed at the finish line. Well, they brought him back, and brought him back from Africa, and they circulated him around the Black community so that people could, you know, celebrate and enjoy his victory. And from then on, Simo Tap was, you know, on the case.
Right.
We were younger. We had demonstrations. We had write-ins. We had call-ins. We lobbied. We did some of everything. We were on fire. And that is how we started, and we're still at it, Ron, 31 years later.
Well, one of the amazing things about, and I've always respected this, I guess because I believe in institution building, and I've said this many, many times, is the one of the most, in addition to the media work that you've done and the civil rights work and all of the different things that have become a part of CMOTEP, including the monthly forums, which we're going to talk about in a minute, is the fact that you were able to get a space. I mean, you were able to get people together to invest and whatever, and so you have a space, CMOTEP has. Talk about that, how you were able to get people to invest so that you have a place. You know?
Let me tell you, it was not difficult at all, because as I said before, you know, people were excited to know that there was some organization that was in a struggle to see that we were represented equitably in media. We had three clubs. We had the 10 club, the 20 club, and the 40 club. The 10 club was to take care of the expenses that had to do with printing and what have you. The 20 club had to do with establishing a decent account for handling any expenses that we needed to have. And the 40 club was to be held in order to purchase a building. Well, the 40 club members were only asked to give $40 a month for 1 year. Most of them started giving $48 two and three times a month for 1 year. We didn't have to beg for anyone, from anyone. I told Dr. William Jones, who has was very, very involved in civil and human rights in his church over there in Brooklyn.
Oh, yes, right.
And I told him, I said, you know, we're going to create a building. We're going to purchase a building that, so that we can sit down and have our discussions and we won't have to be rushed out. You know, he gave us $250, and with that deep voice, take this darling and go forth and do it. And let me tell you something, I will never forget that man and what he did for us. And he invited us to come to his church, and after his church was over, he had indicated to his members after the service they could go downstairs and join a very important organization known as CMOTEP.
Oh, that was wonderful.
And this, and of course, because he sanctioned us in that way, we went to many churches throughout Brooklyn and Manhattan and the Bronx, and the ministers would allow us to take memberships after the service, and then folks joined that 40 club. And within 2 years, we were able to purchase this nice little building, you know, in Southeast Queens, and we've been there ever since. It wasn't, it fixed up, you know, it wasn't, it was a little bit on the shabby side, but now we have it looking the way we want it to look. Because
we had beautiful
people who painted, we had carpenters, we had plumbers, and all of it was given to us because they knew we were trying to do something to improve how black folks are portrayed in media.
Well, you have a very big, and you have this, these forums every month. They're very powerful forums. I've had the privilege of speaking at three or four of them, or I don't know how many over the years, and they're very, very powerful, informative, and they're distributed around and whatever. And you have a very important one coming up. They're always action-oriented and information and action-oriented, and you have a very special one coming up at Simotep this coming Saturday. Talk to us about the forum this Saturday.
Yes. I don't know how many of your members are familiar with our political prisoners. These are our brothers who gave, literally gave their lives, you know, to try to make things better for us. And Matula Shakur, I think he's the stepfather of the rapper.
Tupac
Shakur. He's been in prison for 32 years. Now, his minimum sentence was supposed to be in there for life. But after, if you are well-behaved and you do what you're supposed to do, after 30 years, you are generally given, you know, an opportunity when you come before the parole board. They say, okay, well, we'll let you go. He, 2 years ago, his 30 years of, they were up. But would they, the parole board turned him down. He's coming up again for parole. And we are doing our best to see to it that this brother, who was an acupuncturist, who helped black people in so many ways, and who actually was supposed, he wasn't accused of the crime. He was accused of being an accessory to the crime. So we are struggling now, doing everything we can to get letters to the parole board and to get the support that this brother needs to come up and be with his family. His family has kept in touch with him, and he has been a model prisoner. And we're hoping that our community will join with us. We're trying to raise money to do whatever, to help pay his lawyers, to do whatever, to get this brother out of prison so that he doesn't end his life in one of these hell holes that no civilized country should even think of. But, you know, I don't know. To me, jails are an abomination. But anyhow, let me not stray too far. We're having on the 17th people that are well known in our community and people that are trusted and people that have something to say about getting this brother out of prison. And I'm talking about Larry Hamm. I know you've spoken over there. Camille Yarbrough, Inez and Charles Barron, Pam Africa, and Brother Razakan, her husband. They're going to be there on the 17th telling the community how important it is to get this brother out of prison. He had a stroke not too long ago. He has somewhat recovered from the stroke, but he served his time, and he has admitted, he said, he's done everything that he could. He said, okay, I acknowledge that what I did was wrong. Everything that is required to let a person out of jail. But, you know, the fraternal order of the police, they are the ones that are behind him being kept in prison beyond the time that he is supposed to have been, you know, let out of prison. So we're asking our community to come out and help us to help this brother. He is deserving of it. Right. He taught so many people in Brooklyn acupuncture. He is a very outspoken, just a beautiful brother that simply, you know, is in prison because, how does he have to say, white folks won't let him out. But he should be out. He deserves to be out. He served 32 years. So, you know, give him an opportunity. So everyone that's listening, you know, to my voice, this is what we're trying to do. We want to help in doing that. And then following that, particular. Well,
wait. Let's because we're about to run out of time. Let's give the time and the place so everybody knows on the phone and the contact.
Okay. It's at Semotap Center, 13505 Rockaway Boulevard, South Ozone Park. Very easy to get to. If you're coming by car, you take the Van Wyck Expressway, come off at the Rockaway Boulevard exit, and you're right. We're about half a block off the Van Wyck Expressway.
That's right.
And the number 5, the Q5 bus, stops directly in front of the building. It's at 2 p.m. on the 17th of March. And, of course, following the event, we always invite our community and guests to come and have a meal with us.
And excellent food. Excellent food.
Sort of relax a bit after the struggle. You know, we like to eat. You like to eat, Ron.
Right.
We like to eat certain
foods. That's right. We have great food. What's the phone number?
You're going to call 347-907-0629. And I'm going to repeat that. 347-907-0629. For any information that you would want to get, you can get it by calling that number.
Okay, well, Betty Dobson, amazing. There was some much more I could have talked to you about. The book that you did with three other black women, and there's so much to your story. But we could only get so much in this 30-minute segment. But you are an amazing...
Is it up?
Yeah. We
got I got to talk about Gloria Brown Marshall and Segun Shabaka being our guest for Women's History Month.
Right, okay, well, we can get
and
that
That's on the 24th at 2 o'clock.
Right, okay, well, we are out of time, but the major focus for today, and I really wanted to focus on, is Mutulu Shakur. We really do need, and I'll push this later on the show,
people
need to turn out and provide their support to get Mutulu Shakur out. He has fought for us. It is now time for us to fight for him.
Well
so, Betty Dobson, we thank you so much for being the amazing black woman that you are, freedom fighter, visionary, and courageous institution builder. And we'll see you the next time here on Vantage Point.
Thank you, homie. I'm going to talk about you. I'm going to a meeting tonight. So.
All right. Okay.
You take care.
All right. We're going to take a break here. Come back, and we'll be with Andrea James, our next amazing black woman here on Vantage Point.
Well, Porgy and Bess came and performed in San Francisco, and someone told me they are looking for a dancer. So I thought, and they would pay much more, and I'd get a chance to travel around the United States and maybe get a chance to go to Europe. I auditioned for them, and they accepted me. I sang the role Ruby. But the truth is, I couldn't really sing. I mean, I could sing, but I wasn't a trained singer. I really was a dancer. And at least once every 2 or 3 weeks, one of the singers would say to me, Maya, I'm sorry to tell you, but you flatted that G, or you flatted that A. I didn't even know I was singing in the alphabet. I just sang the role. It was a wonderful experience. Because we went all over the world. We arrived in Morocco, and the conductor said that the company was obliged to perform in concert. So they chose and they rehearsed. But I had no aria, so I told the conductor, Alexander Smolins, and he was Russian. When I told him I have no aria, he said, "Bother, don't you please you all go on spiritual?"
Well, of course, that's the inimitable voice of Maya Angelou, of course. And what an amazing life she had, by the way. She's had some amazing things in her life. Really, really incredible, you know, the life that she lived and the legacy that she left. Well, now we want to turn to another amazing black woman, and we'll be doing this for the rest of the month, and that is none other than Andrea James, and she is founder of Families for Justice and Healing, and she hails from Boston, Massachusetts. Andrea James, welcome to Vantage Point.
Thank you, Dr. Daniels. It's so great to be here and to talk with you. Thank you.
All right. Well, just want to sort of talk about to our listening audience. You've been on the show maybe a couple years back, but they haven't. We haven't talked lately, and I thought we would do a nice little profile today. I so respect the work that you've done over the years, and the work that you continue to do is very unique. It's important and valuable. All those good things. But let's just begin with your background. You're in, back in the day, we should say Boston, but you're in Boston now, or in the environs. Are you originally from Boston, or did you hail from other parts?
Nope, I'm originally from Boston. My family has been in Roxbury for five generations and in the same home for four generations. So originally hail from Roxbury, Massachusetts, very proud African-American community, very rich in culture, very rich in protest, very rich in advancement of our people from a place of self-determination. And so that's where I come from. Come from a strong family here who has raised us to understand the importance of movement building from a place of self-determination. And so that's where I come from.
So talk to us about that a little bit. Your mother, your father, your family. Tease that out a little bit for us. What does that mean? What were the kinds of things that your family did that illustrated that, and how did they sort of help you and your siblings to absorb that?
Oh, my goodness. Well, you know, my grandmother broke the color barrier here in Boston for black nurses. So she was one of the first black nurses to gain entry into nursing at Boston City Hospital at a time when they refused to allow black nurses with RN degrees to work in even public hospitals. Until the war, and there was a nursing shortage, and they ran out of bringing nurses from places like Canada, white nurses, and finally they said, okay, we're going to open the door. Well, my grandmother kicked that door down, really, and never looked back, and so my grandfather did the same thing, and were just incredible people who, my grandfather immigrated here at the age of 14 on a carrier ship from Barbados. And raised himself and met my grandmother, and they married, and my grandparents raised my mother and my uncle. My uncle was the first black tenured law professor at UCLA, taught constitutional law, and was a premier labor lawyer in the country before he passed prematurely from cancer. And my aunt was the first lead black pediatrician in LA County. My parents were both educators and researchers of people of African diaspora. They both went into the prisons going as far back as the civil rights movement and teaching in those places and teaching outside of those places and long community meetings. I grew up many times asleep, falling asleep as a kid at these community meetings, and it's very interesting that my girls and now my 8-year-old boy has grown up doing the same thing. So we've got a long, rich family history of movement building and working from within our communities, knowing that that is really the people most directly affected have to be in the lead in creating meaningful change.
So where did you go to school?
I went to school at Milton Academy, so I got to see, I was very privileged in the respect of education. I come from a family that believes that, you know, you are, education is the most important thing. I grew up in a house that was lined wall to wall with books, and family that was always reading and they're always putting other books in your hand. And then, because of that, I also had the privilege of attending very elite school, Milton Academy, and it was elite in, I want to say it was elite in terms of some forms of education. The older I got, the more that I ended up leaving that school as a teenager, because I just, it was kind of a, my first act of revolt and protest, because I recognized very early on the difference in the treatment of white, very wealthy and very privileged young people who are doing and experimenting as young people do, the same way that young people and black children were experimenting with, you know, all kinds of things, sex, drugs, alcohol, you know, testing out little, you know, acts of being mischief, getting into, you know, fist fights and things like that that young people that go through. And the same was happening on this very elite campus in a number of different ways, and add to what the experiences of me as a black girl were at that school, racism as well, deeply baked in racism from folks that didn't really recognize it, that or would have identified themselves as being racist. And so it was a very interesting, very difficult and trying early life experience for me, the older that I got, and all the things that my parents and my family and my grandparents have been pouring into me about the struggle of black people for equality and for dignity. All of that had a deep effect on me, and I started to see the very clear difference between how young people at that school were treated and wrapped around and just, you know, held and poured into life-saving everything from drug treatment to, you know, whatever they needed to tutoring, to everything to keep them on track, to taking breaks when they needed to take a break, and to going off and you know, taking a vacation whenever life got too tough for them, as opposed to the kids that I came home every day, rode the public transportation back to my community of Roxbury, and it was just very different. And my friends that I was growing up in were not, didn't have that, those same supports. My friends were actually prosecuted, incarcerated as children, sent to the baby jail over here at Harvard Street in Dorchester, you know, started their path. Each one of them that I'm thinking back on now, many of them I'm still friends with, as I still live in the same community, five generations of us, many of them are still cycled in and out, some now serving long adult prison sentences. So the policies that created that, and the focus of the policies on our children in black communities as a way to suppress and oppress movement building, that was something that I recognized acutely at a very young age, and most of it is because I had that dual experience of seeing what was not happening in other communities as opposed to what was happening to black children in the neighborhoods that I lived in.
Now, eventually you became Esquire, right? You became a lawyer. Is that sort of what drove you to become a lawyer, and where did you go to law school?
Well, yeah, I mean, the work that I had seen all around me all my life is what drove me to want to become a lawyer. I, you know, would go and to court with friends, and at that time, back then, they don't allow it too much in court these days, but children could actually go into a courtroom and sit in the courtroom and hear all this stuff, and we heard horrific stuff. I mean, we would go as teenagers and hear all of these horrific things about, back then, it was all young black men who were the older brothers of my friends, and we loved these guys. These guys were our older brothers. They were our protectors in the neighborhood. They made sure that we also did what we were supposed to be doing, like staying in school. They were amazing leaders in our community, and they were also engaged in other survival things that they did because of the inequality and economic access to jobs and other things that everybody needs in order to live. And so they engaged in other ways of finding income. And some also, because of the stresses of life, had succumbed to the illness of addiction, and much of their activities that involved law enforcement and the courts were a result of them needing help with that, them needing treatment, them needing other supports around an illness. and that they did not receive, as opposed, you know, what they did receive was punishment. And so that outraged me. And at that time, I also had grown up in a family with, you know, lawyers. My uncle was one of my heroes, and there was nothing, because of what my family poured into me, that I didn't think that I could do or become. And so it was just a natural thing for me, all of this kind of alchemy of experiences that came together, and law was just something that I wanted to use. Thurgood Marshall was also somebody who I poured over his work, poured over what he did and how he went about doing his work. And it was just something that resonated with me still to this day. The work of the law just resonates with me. And although I am a disbarred lawyer now, it was something that when I started out, I never thought of doing anything else in life, ever.
And so you speak about being disbarred. I don't know what connection that has to the organization that you created, but let's talk about you. You eventually created an organization, excuse me, I may be mispronouncing it, Families for Justice and Healing. How did that come about?
Well, yeah, so I was a lawyer, and I had two parts to my practice. I was a lawyer. I was very proud of my law office located in Roxbury, Massachusetts, and right on the Dudley Street corridor, which is one of the main corridors that run through the African-American community. That was always my dream, to have a law office in my community. Never thought of going downtown, although I had plenty of offers to do big firm work even after law school. But I attended Northeastern Law School. I had the great, great experience of attending law school at Northeastern while David Hall was the dean. And David Hall is African-American dean, an incredible, incredible leader in this space, just taught from a very different lens the law to us, and challenged us every day through that experience of law school to challenge laws and don't accept them as being right just because they were laws. And so that was an incredible experience. David Hall is now the president of the University of the Caribbean, I believe, the University of West Indies. I might be saying that wrong, but incredible leader in the space that I had the honor of learning under. But I had a law practice, and most of my practice, I started out doing criminal defense work and was part of the Committee for Public Counsel Services, which is the public defender agency in Massachusetts, and the Youth Advocacy Project, even prior to law school. And that experience transcended into my work I did when I went into private practice. And I was a criminal defense attorney for the most part, a trial lawyer, and, you know, I also, some couple years into my practice, was wooed by a very lucrative area of law that had historically not been open and accessible to black lawyers, never mind black women lawyers, and that was real estate conveyance. And I really didn't know what that was, but I knew it was lucrative and that it could really provide me with an opportunity to do more of the community building work through my law office and the criminal defense work that many clients did not pay our office for. We did that mostly on a pro bono bar advocacy basis. And these were grandmothers who used to bring bags of fruit to pay me because their grandchildren who they had in their custody were tangled up in the legal system. And so I became a real estate conveyance lawyer as well, and increasingly those practices by banks became even more predatory. We're already in our community and black communities across the country reeling from decades of this intentional legislative enacted policy and policy that was intentional about using practices and using law enforcement to oppress and control as opposed to help to build and uplift. And so we were already struggling under this weight of the war on crime, the war on drugs, all of these wars that were really just a war against black people. And now here comes along in a community and communities like the city that are within the city of Boston, predatory lending. And predatory lending was devastating for a community like Roxbury and for a city like Boston, because there's working poor and working people in all of these neighborhoods. And in a city like Boston, we had been so racially segregated, you know, in such a horrific, really, way. But at the same time, it kept us all together in the black community, and we had some great community and as a result of the fact that we have been segregated so badly. But what it also meant, as I started out in this conversation with you, Dr. Daniels, we're five generations in Roxbury, four generations in the same house. And so when you bring something like predatory lending, it literally wipes out a community. And I'm sure that it was all part of that move to begin to shift the white influx back now into very valuable geographical areas that are very close to the downtown money centers of cities. And these are the communities that we now see that black families and brown people are being pushed out of and being replaced by white people. And so that was the start of that, really, in the early 2000s, a real uptick, a real push as we fought. And I was on one side of my law practice. I represented the people as a criminal defense attorney. On the other side of my real estate conveyance practice, real estate conveyance lawyers, for the most part, during that time, we represented banks. And where you couldn't get a loan, where they redlined our community for decades, now they were coming into the community with the most outrageous predatory lending tools. It took me a little while to figure that all out, but I did eventually figure it all out. And even though I did have a very lucrative practice representing banks in closings, not the people around the closing table, I still, once I began to open up my eyes and wake up to what was really happening, I started to encourage and to not close these loans, to tell people to get up from the closing table and leave, that this is an extraordinary predatory loan. That turned into somewhat of a movement on my behalf that I should not have done. It was a poor use of judgment. It took away the one tool that I had, which was my license to practice law, to continue to use that to help my people. And I lost it by making some poor choices around things that I did. I was charged with wire fraud. I was prosecuted. I was convicted. I was sentenced to serve a two-year federal prison sentence in 2010. And I did. I went and did that. I, at the time, had two older daughters. My husband and I, we had a baby girl who was 12 at the time, who's now a junior at Spelman College. And I, at that time, we had also had our last child, who was 5 months old, and our baby boy. And so that was an incredibly traumatic experience in so many ways. But I walked into this prison. I lived there for 2 years with women who literally had been there for 20 years, black women who had been warehoused in this place for 15, 12. They hadn't seen their children for 6 and 7 years. They were thousands of miles away. They were warehoused like a slave ship, stacked on top of each other, bunk after bunk after bunk. And they were there for reasons that nobody should be incarcerated for. And so inside that prison, in the prison yard, we sat around a table and we started an organization called Families for Justice as Healing. And that organization is alive and well in Boston, Massachusetts. It's a policy advocacy organization, and it's an organization that pushes for prison abolition. We've fought to stop women's jails from being built. We've ended shackling of pregnant incarcerated women during labor and delivery. Yes, that happens in this country in more states than not. We shackle pregnant incarcerated women during labor and delivery. You have to remember the policies of incarceration when it comes to women are all policies that derive from the slavery, the treatment of black women during slavery. And those policies have evolved, and now, albeit they affect all incarcerated women, but they were derived from the inhumane and brutal treatment of black women during slavery and post-slavery, during all the iterations of oppression and control of black people. And so that's why we started Families for Justice as Healing. We wanted to make sure that women who were directly affected, that women who were sitting on those prison bunks, that women that had been taken from their communities, and even prior to them being taken from their communities, they had held their families down while the men and boys had been stripped from their communities for all of those years prior to that, leading to what we now call this thing called mass incarceration. And so women have always borne the brunt of the pressure of that, The economic pressure, the familial pressure, all of those things, the trauma, the emotional trauma, the sadness of all of this that our the women in our communities have endured and held together. And so that's why we started our work. That work subsequently, Dr. Daniels, has led to a national movement called the National Council for Incarcerated and Formerly Incarcerated Women and Girls. And that's currently what we're involved in right now. We are thousands of incarcerated and formerly incarcerated women and our movement family, women who are the, just like I described, who are the women who have held us together, our communities and our families together through this incredible onslaught of terrorism against our people.
Well, that experience is a classic example of the sort of the positive coming out of the negative. It's almost like a Malcolm X story, you know, where Malcolm goes to prison, is transformed in many respects, and comes out differently. Yours is not quite the same because you were never really involved in negative behavior in the first place. But nonetheless, that experience, you know, propelled you to take your skills. And I know you did this book called, what's the book? Something about bunkers? What is it?
Yep. So the title of the book is Upper. Sorry, I got to get my R's together for all of you who aren't from Boston. Upper Bunkies Unite and Other Thoughts on the Politics of Mass Incarceration. And I wrote that book while sitting on a prison bunk. I wrote that book over the 2 years that I was incarcerated, and I refused to change it when I came home. There's all sorts of typos in it and all sorts of other things, but you get the message, right, from what I wrote. And I'm working on another book now, and I self-published that book. I couldn't get anybody to publish it for me. No publishing companies really cared about hearing about the story of that I was talking about. Of course, we have Orange is the New Black, and publishing companies have made, you know, the experience of mass incarceration of women, you know, that poster person as a white woman with no children, which is the furthest thing away from what the reality of women in incarceration is. But, you know, we keep writing. We encourage all of our members to keep writing. We think that there is nothing more important than the storytelling of women and men and everybody and our youth who have gone through these experiences.
And you, I forget what years ago now, maybe 3 or 4 years ago, one of the, I would suspect, a turning point in your work was you had this ambition of having this march on Washington and this rally because you really, really wanted to galvanize an understanding of this issue. And you traveled the country, crisscrossed hither and thither and all over the place, and it came about. Talk to us about that women's march that you organized.
Wow, that was something. We were just desperate. You know, we really worked hard to push out women, as many women as we could, out of incarceration in the federal system, because we had a president at the time who was willing to work on that, to understand that there were just black folks, predominantly people who were just warehoused and had been in prison unjustly for decades. And many women were who were in our membership and that we had been and served time with. We were desperate to get home. Grandma Phyllis Hardy, you know, Ramona Brandt, Michelle West, Alice Johnson, these women that we were just, you know, kind of desperate to try and bring home. But nobody seemed to understand this. When we had this conversation, you know, as we started to come out of the prison and start to do our work, literally standing on street corners, literally with a fold-up table, with handing out information about the federal prison system and the women that we had left behind and who was in there and who didn't need to be there, and no money, like making dishcloths and selling dishcloths to, you know, for $2 a dishcloth just to get gas money to go from place to place. And IBW, Dr. Daniels, your organization, Institute of the Black World, and Nana Roz, I mean, you helped us to move around. I mean, we literally didn't have gas money and nowhere to sleep. And you made sure through the movement that we were taken care of and that our message was heard. And you gave us that initial platform when nobody else was paying attention. And Kichi Taifa and Jesslyn McCurdy, these sisters who just came and stood by us and still to this day continue to kick open those doors for us and make sure that we're still included on these platforms that are being increasingly commandeered by the far right and other people that are changing the scope of the work. But that march was the beginning of that. That march was to say, we're out here. We're not asking anybody's permission to do this. We have something to say, and we need people to hear it. And, you know, it's grown. That march has turned into what is now the National Council. All of that crisscrossing across the country still is being done. I'm in a different city every single week, Dr. Daniels, speaking to women that are most directly affected, up deep in the blocks, up deep in the housing developments, talking to sisters around kitchen tables, because meaningful change is not going to happen by some big splash of some celebrated something. Meaningful change is going to happen in the local communities, around those kitchen tables, where these sisters and these brothers are sitting around and having conversations and mobilizing to create the change, and then that sharing that information and sharing that information and sharing that information and connecting the dots. That's what we do at the National Council.
Well, it's an amazing bit of work, and I really wanted to have you on because I really, really respect what you have done. Learned so much from you as you were going from city to city. I was learning a lot about women incarcerated and how that's different than men being incarcerated. And so I must say I learned a great deal, and I'm deeply indebted to you for that. And we just have to say that one of the things that occurred too was, you know, you became a Soros Justice Fellow, and that was in recognition of the work that you've done. And that's because you're an amazing woman and an amazing black woman. And so we really, really thank you for being on this morning. But we have to let you give your website and phone number out so people can who want to connect and contribute or whatever. Where can people contact you?
Yep. Well, the national organization that everybody can click on to and click on the join button. We do not want to have to continue to be beholden to funders. It's not always easy to convey how important this work is to funders. They don't really always quite get it. And so we're working on that, too. But we have a membership drive that's going on right now so that we can at least be able to keep our lights on and keep the, you know, bills paid to while we're doing this work on the ground in our communities. And so that website is thecouncil.us, thecouncil.us. And that's our national movement called the National Council for Incarcerated and Formerly Incarcerated Women and Girls. There's a very quick membership page that you can click on and join. Just ask you, are you formally incarcerated or not? And then you will support us with a very nominal fee of $5 a year that allows us to do this work without having to ask others to fund us to do this work. The other local organization, if you are in the Boston area or you just want to simply support us, the Motherlode, the organization that started all of the national work, that organization is alive and well and doing amazing things in Boston, Massachusetts. That is Families for Justice As, not and, but As Healing, because we want to heal our people.
Right.
So Justice As Healing. And that website is justiceashealing.org.
Okay. All right. Well, Andrea James, keep on keeping on. And you have great energy and enthusiasm, and I think the audience feels it, and we know that the work that is in your DNA, because it comes all the way through your family line for all these generations, will contribute to making this our people and this country and this world a better place. Thank you so much for spending your time with us this morning on Vantage Point.
Thank you for showing us the love, Dr. D, and for always, always, my IBW family out there, I love you, and thank you for always supporting us. Thank you.
All right, okay, we're going to take a break here, and we're going to get you on the phone so you can talk about amazing black women that you know and say a word about. We're going to take a break, come back, give you the phone number after we take this break. We'll be right back.
in Morocco, and the conductor said that the company was obliged to perform in concert. So they chose and they rehearsed. But I had no aria. So I told the conductor, Alexander Smolens, and he was Russian. When I told him I have no aria, he said, "Bother, don't you at least know one spiritual?" And I thought, "Is grits groceries? Do I know a spiritual? What?" And I just grinned and thought about Stamps, Arkansas, where from the time I was 3, Mama took me to church on Sunday. Then on Monday evening, we went to missionary meeting. Tuesday evening, usher board meeting. Wednesday evening, prayer meeting. Thursday evening, choir practice. We went to church all the time. And at all those meetings, we sang. So I told the man, "Yes, I know a spiritual." So I stood on the stage alone and sang, "I am a poor pilgrim of sorrow. I'm lost in this wide world alone." I sang her song. And when I finished, 4,500 Arabs jumped up and hit the floor and started to shout, "Walai lazim Allah walai." And I looked stage right at the wings where the singers had sung. And they were looking at me like, so I said, "I'm sorry. I mean, you sang Puccini and Bach and Beethoven and Haydn. And I sang what W.B. Du Bois called the sorrow songs. Songs written not by a free and easy people, not by a leisure class. Songs written from the heart, written with their blood, written with the whips and the lash on their back. When I sung these songs, the people couldn't stop screaming. Then I began to think, ah, I see. Now I see. When the people were passing out the big packets of land and money, my people had none of that to give me. But what they gave me, look at what they gave me. My Lord, look at what they gave me. It opens doors for me all over the world."
Okay, we're back. Maya Angelou on the break. Compliments of our chief announcer, Michael G. Haskins. This coming Saturday at 2 o'clock p.m. at CMOTEP's headquarters, that's in Jamaica, Queens, there's going to be a major forum dedicated to raising resources. Well, first of all, public awareness, but also raising resources to try to make a major push to free Mutulu Shakur, a political prisoner who's been in jail now for 32 years. He is no danger to society. Never really was. But at his age, having just had a stroke, this is just punishment. This is punitive. This is the absence of a sense of restorative justice, frankly, in these United States of America. It is vindictiveness. It's his punishment. It is, and it's embedded in a lot of us, you know, just punish him, you know, just, and particularly with the Fraternal Order of Police and so forth, it's this notion that some people are more valuable than others. So, you know, if you're involved in anything that's related to a police officer, then you lock him up, throw away the key, and you die. Just die. We've got to change that in general for all people. It is just not. And these people be going to church every Sunday, too, many of them. And they be, you know, Hail and Mary and a whole bunch of other stuff. It's just not the way to go. But we who have benefited from the struggles of people like Mutulu Shakur, freedom fighters, who put their lives on the line, we have to fight for them. And so we encourage you, our listening audience, to pack CMOTEP's hall on this coming Saturday at 2 o'clock p.m. as people like Larry Ham, I call him Chairman Larry Ham, the longtime chairman of the People's Organization for Crop Progress, eloquent, powerful, dedicated leader for so many years, will be there. Charles and Inez Barron will be there. Others that I heard names will be there in support of this cause. Nana, Camille Yarborough, and many others will be there. So you can call for further information, 347-907-0629, 347-907-0629. We heard it from the voice of one of our amazing, truly amazing black women. I mean, just her story. of how C-Motep got started. And she is like, you know, she's still going strong. She's an elder, but she is still going strong. Now traveling back and forth from Youngstown, Ohio to come to New York and maintaining this organization. She is just an incredible person. She's my homie, Betty Dobson, but that's sort of beside the point. We all recognize her for the work that she has done. And so she encourages everyone to be there at C-Motep this coming Saturday, 2 o'clock p.m. Call again, 347-907-0629. And that is in support of the political prisoner, Mutulu Shakur. Let's get him out. Let's put pressure on to say enough is enough. Let him breathe some free air. As a freedom fighter, he was denied his freedom. Now it's time for him to be free. Well, we want to invite people to list to call in. Specifically, though, however, we're doing tributes to amazing black women. So that's what we really want to talk about, is if you have someone you just want to give a shout out to, some person that you feel has done amazing work. Does not have to be some famous person, you know, and anything like that. I'd like, you know, just people that you know in our community. These stories of amazing women who have done such incredible work for so many years. Your opportunity to salute and share that. We'll have more next week and the following week as well. 347-335-0818. 347-335-0818. We'll get you into the conversation. As we wait for people to join in the conversation, I just want to begin to alert people. We have, through the Institute of the Black World 21st Century, WBAI supported when we did State of the Black World Conference back in 2016, an amazing conference. One of the outcomes was we said we were going to focus on Newark as a model city. We were going to aggregate resources from all over Black America to focus on Newark, New Jersey. So on April 3rd and the 4th, there will be a symposium on a Marshall Plan. Second day will be a summit on economic development, all focused on Newark, bringing professional leaders, investors, policy analysts, from all faith leaders from all over the country to Newark, New Jersey, in support of the progressive policies on economic development of the Honorable Roz J. Baraka and the rich history of that city. The symposium and the economic summit will be really, frankly, by closed events. They're just small events. But the public event where you'll meet and greet all of these people in celebration of what's going on in Newark, but also in the spirit of Dr. Martin Luther King, will be a town hall meeting at the Robert Treat Hotel, and it will be built on the theme from the mountaintop to the promised land, King's economic journey for economic justice. And Danny Glover, that's right, Danny Glover will be here as the keynote speaker. And you can go to our website right now, IBW21.org, to begin to get that information, IBW21.org, to see the initial save the date. And that's only about 3 weeks, but we're asking you to save the date. You'll be hearing more about that here on WBII as we begin to push and pound this, because we want a packed house, standing room only, for Danny Glover and others come in the spirit of Martin Luther King, talk about economic development in Newark as we focus on Newark as a model city. Let's go to our first caller. Good morning. You're on Vantage Point.
Thank you, Mr. Daniels, for having your program. I really appreciate it. I look forward to it every Monday.
Thank you.
I'd like to know that March the 10th was Harriet Tubman Day. It was set aside by Congress in 1990. Right. And I don't hear too much about it, you know, in our community, people trying to, you know, speaking of Harriet Tubman or really using the day as our holiday. Can you speak on that, please?
Well, I think it's one of those things we just need to put more publicity around. And I'm glad that I'm going to be honest about it. I'm aware that there was an effort to make this happen. I'm guilty. I did just got completely around me, because I think we have to do more organizing around it. And why that's important, I'm teaching a class now at York, and that's my class today. It's Black Social and Political Thought, and I really wanted to teach this class so badly, because there's so much in our history. Our young people don't know about our heroes and sheroes of the past and what they've done, and certainly Harriet Tubman and particularly in the state of New York, is one of them that we ought to know more about. So I'm glad that you called and talked about that. And who knows, maybe next week we'll devote a whole segment to that. Just because you called and shared it. So I'm making a note of that, because I got to admit to you, it got by me totally, and it should not get by me. So thank you so much for calling and reminding me.
And also, like, there's another date that was set aside that we shouldn't. It was Emancipation Day. It was set aside by the UN to celebrate the day of emancipation from slavery all over the world. And we don't hear too much about that. I mean, I think in England they have a big holiday then, but in this country you don't hear anything about it. So maybe you can do some research on that and enlighten us on that date and have an event that we can all celebrate.
Right. Well, we talked early on around Emancipation Day about why it's no longer has the same resonance that it once did in our community. So that's a just topic as well. Thanks much. Really appreciate it. We're going to try to do this segment on Harriet Tubman next week, though, just because you called and reminded of us. Appreciate it. Others can call at 347-335-0818, 347-335-0818, in order to, particularly if there are women in your life, your family, and the community you'd like to shout out and say they are amazing, amazing black women. It would be very, very, very helpful, you know, to do that. So give us a call. Again, the number is 347-335-0818. Good morning. You're on Vantage Point.
You'd like to shout out and say...
Please turn your radio down. Hello.
Hey. Very, very, very helpful, you know, to do
good
that.
Good morning. Please turn your radio down.
The number is 347.
Hello. You're on the air. Hello.
Good morning. You're on Vantage Point.
Yes, hi.
Yeah, please turn your radio down. We have a delay system, and we're hearing your radio in the background.
Okay, am I on?
Yes, you are. Yes.
Yes, yes. Good morning. Good morning.
Good morning.
I'm so glad I got through. I missed part of the program. I'm sorry. But in lieu of what you're speaking about today, I had a pen pal in prison, Chaz Ransom, for over 25 years, and he got out of prison this past summer and passed away 3 months later, and I didn't even know about it till after the funeral, so I'm still traumatized by it. I finally got to meet him when he got out, but he just unfortunately disappeared out of my life. I would like to be a pen pal for a woman prisoner at this point, if that's possible. If you can direct me to the right place to do that.
Well, I can't immediately do that, but let me give it some thought, and maybe I can share that on our program next week.
Okay. Should I call anybody up, or just listen to your program next week?
Well, I'll try to remember that next week. There are organizations, the Jericho organization. You can, in fact, you can Google Jericho, the Jericho movement, and the Jericho movement is one of the organizations that does work around political prisoners.
Jericho movement?
Yes. There's also a Malcolm X Commemoration Committee, Malcolm X Commemoration Committee here in New York that works with political prisoners as well. Now, I don't know whether there is... with women political prisoners, I'm not as clear about that. But nonetheless, those are two places that I would direct you to go.
Great. Thank you so much. Love your program. Thank you.
Thank you much. Really appreciate it. Others can call. Specifically, I'd like to hear if there are women. The first was Harriet Tubman. Harriet Tubman's now, obviously, she's deceased and all that. But there are, I'm sure, living women right now that some of you know in the community that you'd like to uphold because... their teachers, their parents, their community organizers, their big mamas or grandmamas, and people who just do good work in the community that you just want to give a shout out to. This is your opportunity to do so. We'll do the same thing next week. 347-335-0818. 347-335-0818. Again, 347-335-0818 is what I'm looking for, are these tributes, these upholding of women. Good morning. You're on Vantage Point.
Yes, sir. Vantage Point. Taking advantage, you know?
Yes, sir.
Of this blackness in America. So, sir, you say about Harriet Tubman going to be in the $20 bill?
I didn't hear what you said.
Harriet Tubman, where's she going to be, on the $20 bill?
I'm not sure about that, but what we do know is that it's on, you know, there's been acts passed to celebrate her, and so we want to try to deal with that next week, because frankly, as I said before, she should be celebrated. Work was put in to get it passed. She did a lot of work here in the state of New York, and so next week we're going to try to figure out a way to spend some time talking about Harriet Tubman and her work and how she is being celebrated, and why really we should have more recognition of her around the day, February, I think it was March 10th, I'm sorry, that was laid out as Harriet Tubman Day. So stay tuned and we'll try to get that information to you.
Oh, so they're not, I'm just trying to see if they are here somewhere.
We're
going
to try to get that information to you, because I'm saying I'm negligent for not having all that information at our disposal. We'll try to share it with our listening audience next week.
Okay, so you don't have that information by hand right now?
I don't.
Okay. Well, it's a good program, man. I like the African holistic, you know, continue this struggle, you know, because it's a struggle, you know, we just have to keep fighting, you know.
Right.
Spiritually,
right.
Mentally, and just keep informing the masses, because information is what they need, you know, to really realize what's really going on around their surrounding, in the community, and in the world.
Right.
So lack of information, man. We're ignorant, and poverty is crazy, man.
Right.
We need information, man. We need
that's
to keep
right.
giving information, man. You understand?
Right. We're giving it. That's what we're trying to do on Vantage Point. Look, thanks for your call. Really appreciate it. Others can call at 347-335-0818. Can I get one or two tributes to a amazing black woman that you know that's alive right now? That's what I'm looking for. 347-335-0818. 347-335-0818. Good morning. You're on Vantage Point. Please turn, and when y'all call, please turn your radio down. We have a delay system here, and when I can hear the radios in the background, it doesn't work, and it really holds us up from getting other callers on. So speak right to us. Good morning. You're on Vantage Point. Good morning.
So speak right to us. Good morning.
We're going to have to go to the let's go to the next caller, because folks, when you can't play your radio and take a call at the same time, you just have to turn your radio down, because we have a delay system, and we just wasted 30 seconds. 347-335-0818, and we only got 4 minutes left. 347-335-0818. Turn your radios down. Speak to us directly when you come on Vantage Point. Good morning. You're on Vantage Point. Good morning.
Good morning.
You're on the air.
Oh, thank you. Great program. I just would like to give a commemorative shout-out to Bettie Jean Miller,
okay,
who formed the Harlem Gateway Committee, which was at Central Park North. She also had the street name changed from 110th Street to Central Park North. She was a community activist, very well known in the community, hailed from Little Rock, Arkansas, and had done so much for the community there on Central Park North. So I just wanted to give a commemorative shout out to Bettie Jean Miller, who passed last May 2nd.
Okay. Thank you so much. That's exactly what I'm looking for, is to get those names out there, because so many times we just know the most famous people. It doesn't have to be the famous people. It's people like that who made contributions in the community, did the work, and need to be recognized. Thank you so much. Really, really appreciate it. Others in the same spirit, get a couple more callers in at 347-335-0818. 347-335-0818. Good morning. You're on Vantage Point.
Good morning. You have a great show, and I would just like to shout out Michelle Milligan and Nisha Milligan. That's my wife and my daughter, two great black women.
All right. Okay. Doesn't get any better than that.
Thank you very much.
All right. Let's see. Can we get one more in? 347-335-0818. Amazing black women in the community that are, well, they may just be good daughters and good wives and partners, but others are doing work in the community and contributing as the person who was called out earlier in Central Park North. Good morning. You're on Vantage Point.
Good morning. Couple of things. One, I don't think you missed Harriet Tubman last week. I think it's because, you know, they keep preempting you for Gary Noll ad nauseum. So I'd like Gary Noll, but the way we do these fundraisers, we spend too much time on them and we miss so much that's going on, especially since for a long period of time. So I had to quickly say that. Secondly, Adelaide Sanford.
Ah, wonderful. Yes.
I love this woman, and especially since we have supposedly a progressive mayor in place who keeps looking for everybody other than New Yorkers who are more than qualified. They didn't put Banks in there for police commissioner, and now
that music in the background means I've got to go short, but Adelaide Sanford is a good place to end this tribute to amazing black women. In fact, we had her on a couple of years ago on the show. Thanks so much. Really appreciate it. This is the Professor Dr. Ron Daniels thanking you for tuning in to Vantage Point this week, and we'll see you again next week on 99.5 FM here on WBAI with the Pacifica Network in collaboration with YCRadio.org.
Visionary Senator Nina Turner is coming to New York to celebrate WBAI. We will in turn celebrate her work on the front lines on behalf of all Americans. On Friday, March 30th, join WBAI in honoring former Ohio State Senator Nina Turner for her visionary progressive work from the streets to the halls of power. You can join us for dinner with a senator. Your gift of $175 to WBAI gets you into this exclusive event at NBA icon Clyde Frazier's Wine and Dine on the corner of 10th Avenue and 37th Street. Your donation includes dinner, a free copy of Nina Turner's book, Grandma's Bones, and her latest interview on WBAI. Don't miss this unique opportunity on Friday, March 30th, beginning at 6:30 p.m. Your donation supports your favorite radio station and honors a progressive icon at the same time. We can't wait to see you there.
Building bridges your community and labor report. From your workplace to your neighborhood, listen to the show that brings it all together. Building Bridges, your community and labor report, produced by Mimi Rosenberg and Ken Nash. Bringing you news and analysis, local, national, and international. Monday nights, 7 p.m. We build bridges.
The next Community Advisory Board meeting will be held on March 18th. It will be held at 1 p.m. at the 60 Wall Street Atrium. All listeners are invited to attend. Once again, the next Community Advisory Board meeting will be held on March 18th. It will be held at 1 p.m. at the 60 Wall Street Atrium. All listeners are invited to attend.
WBAI New York, we're at 99.5 FM and WBAI.org on the web. Good afternoon, just about 12 noon here in New York City. The Gary Noll Show is coming up in just a moment. Thank you all so very much for tuning in this morning. A lot of programming coming your way throughout the afternoon. In fact, right after the Gary Noll Show, Heart of Mind with Catherine Davis, and then at 2 p.m., Cat Radio Cafe with Janet Coleman and David Dozer. So, a lot of radio ahead. Keep your dials right where they are at 99.5 FM, BAI. My name is Michael G. Haskins. Have a great rest of the day.